Curious about keeping ahead in the evolving world of effective leadership? Hi, I'm Yana Ibrahimova, and welcome to Mastery Talk, where we decode leadership through a science-backed lens.
And I'm Juliana Cizola. Join us as we dive into leadership wisdom, grounded in the latest research and teachings from Stanford's renowned professors.
Our goal? To transform complex theories into clear, actionable strategies for everyday leadership.
From evidence-based decision-making to the neuroscience of emotional intelligence, innovation, and resilience, we are unpacking it all.
Each episode is a journey into key aspects of leadership guided by Stanford's brightest minds.
We are bridging the gap between the lab and the real world. We are making sure these talks resonate with the challenges you face as a leader.
And whether you are guiding a small team or steering a large organization, we bring you insights that are both profound and applicable.
Get ready to take your leadership mastery to the next level with every conversation you tune into.
And this is Mastery Talks, your getaway to science-backed leadership wisdom. Hello and welcome to Mastery Talks. Today we're hosting Maggie Neal, Professor of Negotiations and Organizational Behavior at Stanford. Maggie is a renowned expert in negotiations, team dynamics, and conflict management.
Margaret is also a well-known author and speaker, famous for making complex ideas easy to understand and implement in real life. Today, we are lucky to have her with us to share her knowledge and insights.
Welcome to Mastery Talks, Maggie. Great to have you here.
Yana, Juliana, great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Maggie, let's start from your book. In your book with Professor Thomas Lees, you've merged economics and psychology to reshape the way we think about negotiations. Mm-hmm. How do you think this combination has transformed the traditional approach to negotiations?
Well, you can sort of go back quite a ways in the research that was done in negotiation. And so when I first got my PhD, which was a long time ago, there were two camps. There was the psychology camp. The psychology camp focused primarily on individual differences or personality. And then there was the economic camp, which said, assume perfect information and see what happens in these kinds of situations. And to the mind of my colleague, who my doctoral advisor and me back in the day, Max Baserman, neither one of these perspectives were particularly helpful. Number one, personality is set when you are a young child. And so what can we say as negotiating researchers that will help you, given that your personality is set and so is your counterparts? There's not much changeability there. And we never found a situation where people could assume full information in a negotiation. Negotiation is an information asymmetry game. I have information, you have information. There may be some overlap, but there could be some things that are very separate and may not be strategically valuable for me to share all my information, right? So then we said, okay, well, what can we change? What can we affect is how we think about the problem and how we respond given those thoughts. And at the same time, there was another stream of research that was going on called behavioral decision theory, which said, what are the systematic irrationalities, as it were, systematic irrationalities that people engage in, these biases? And we, you know, now that's sort of mainstream. We know all about the anchoring bias and the framing bias, representation, all sorts of this stuff, right? And so what we said was, well, maybe we can use these systematic biases to try to predict how people will behave in negotiation. And the notion of systematicity is important because if you're just crazy, I can't help, right? I can't, if you're just like a crazy person and you say, how do I negotiate with a crazy person? My answer is, I don't know. But if you tell me, well, here's somebody who's trying to be reasonable or trying to be rational or trying to maximize their value, I know about systematic biases that we take to those kinds of situations and I can now predict on average, other people's behavior, which allows me as the negotiator to be able to figure out what my best strategic option might be. So that's what we did. We did basically, we called it cognitive negotiation theory because it was about the mind. How do we approach negotiation? How do we think about it? How do we leverage the biases that our counterparts may have? And how do we make sure that we have that we can mitigate the effect of those biases on us? So that was the point. That was back in the 1980s, and I think some of your listeners weren't even born then. But what we did is over the subsequent decades, we expanded that to include emotions as well as things beyond just cognitive, as power, emotions, those sorts of things. Gender have come in to our research, and it has expanded sort of the panorama of what we know about negotiators and how to be more effective. Okay, that's just like the first stage. The second stage was with my co-author, Thomas Leese. So Thomas is trained as an economist, right? And I'm trained as a social psychologist. And so what we thought was an important consideration, you know, given this background of cognitive negotiation theory, was to say, okay, well, let's not ignore the rational actor. Let's use that not as an assumption that we make that everybody's rational, but people are going to try to be rational, right? And then let's bring in psychology and economics and have them sort of integrated to be able to sort of say, okay, what would a reasonable person do? What are the strategies and tactics I would aspire to be able to implement if I were a rational actor, right? And use that as our benchmark for what we're trying to achieve, and then sort of see what human beings do with how they actually behave, the descriptive. So you can think about the economic perspective as being prescriptive. Here's what we should do. And then the psychological comes in with, well, let's predict what people will actually do, right? And so you see that you have those two benchmarks.
Isn't it fascinating how the traditional framework, often dominated by a win-lose paradigm, shifts significantly when psychological aspects like emotions, cognitive biases, and all the human aspects are integrated.
Right? Yeah, relationships too, right? I really care about my counterpart. I want them to get, you know, have a good outcome as well.
Maggie, let's talk a bit about how you reshaped the idea of negotiations from the win-lose paradigm to collaborative problem solving.
So one of the things is as I worked with people and I continued my research career, it was very clear that most people brought a set of assumptions to the negotiation table. And one of the most common and resistant to change assumptions was that negotiation was a fight. And I kind of characterize it in many of my talks as, I'm going to try to get stuff from you that you don't want me to have. And I'm going to try to keep you from getting my stuff, right? And the problem is, if that's how you think about negotiation, then what you're going to see is a situation where you're always trying to win. And that does a couple of things. Number one is, first, it makes your counterpart the other, right? The enemy, the person who's keeping you from getting what you want. But secondly, what happens is, if with that mindset of a battle, it's really easy to think about and focus on who's going to win, right? Who's going to win that battle? And sometimes we get so caught up in who's going to win the battle that we forget what we're fighting over, right? That we're just going to try to exert strategies that we think will get us to be ahead. But maybe we lose a lot in that process because we're so singularly minded focused on winning. And so what I suggested, and I continue to suggest, both based upon my research, but also on the challenges that various groups face when they negotiate, is to think about negotiation not as a battle, but as collaborative problem solving. Now, oftentimes when I say those three words, collaborative problem solving, people go, oh, right, that's that win-win negotiation that we've heard about since the 1980s, right? Fisher and Urey talk about getting to yes. And what I want to suggest is it is not that. It is not about getting to yes. What this is about is a sort of a three-component process. Number one, as the protagonist negotiator, am I better off? Am I better off than my status quo? Am I better off than my alternative? Am I better off than had I not negotiated? Now, that may seem like a low bar. I mean, why would any reasonable person engage in an activity to make themselves worse off? Except that we all have. Every one of us has been in a negotiation, and we knew deep down we should walk away, but we didn't. We chose to stay, right? And we chose a yes over a no. So the first thing is, does this interaction make us better off? Secondly, because negotiation is an interdependent decision process, there's no command and control. I can't force you to say yes. All that I can do is to present proposals where it's in your interest to say yes, and we can agree on a common course of action. What that means is I've got to understand who you are. I've got to do the hard work of planning and preparation to understand more about your interest, your preferences, what drives you, what are the obstacles you face in walking that path of agreement with me. And third, and most importantly, what I need to be able to do is when I make a proposal to you, I'm going to frame that proposal as a solution to a problem that you have. And this, I think, is the real crux of this collaborative problem-solving perspective. Too often when we negotiate, we're focusing on what's in it for me. I get this, I get that. Well, that's actually in the first component, right? That's the, am I better off? By the time I get to the third component, I've got to be creative to find a way to present proposals to my counterpart that from their perspective, at least keeps them whole or perhaps makes them better off. If my proposals always make my counterpart worse off, there's no reason for them to say yes to me. They can walk away. So what I try to do is think about how they have characterized their challenges and their preferences and their interests and what they're looking for in this negotiation. And then try to create a proposal where from their perspective, I can help them solve a problem of theirs. And what I've found from both my research and from my teaching is that if we can embrace this perspective, and by the way, it's actually really hard to do because we have been so steeped in the belief that negotiation's a fight. So to step away from that, right, requires a lot of intention. To step away from that and say, how can I solve, be creative, right? I want to actually do well for me, but in doing so, I also need to be able to understand my counterpart and present a proposal that they can say yes to. So part of what I'm suggesting to folks is if you embrace this perspective, number one, so many more things become open to negotiation because no longer am I going to have to pick and choose who I'm willing to negotiate with based upon who I'm willing to pick a fight with, right? So it opens it up that all of a sudden this sort of this notion of negotiation as fight, right? Collaborative problem solving is, by its nature, an integrative, value-creating strategy. And that what happens is when we embrace that perspective, we are actually much more likely to be able to realize the value, the potential value, the synergy that exists between you and me.
Building on that idea of collaborative problem solving, Maggie, it is clear that how we approach negotiations significantly impacts our outcomes. Mm-hmm. You often emphasize that the goal in negotiation isn't just to strike a deal, but to get a good deal and understanding what constitutes a good deal and how we can identify one.
And yeah, I think that's a really important point because to the extent that we can embrace this collaborative problem-solving perspective, so many more things become open to negotiation, right? Which means we're going to have to develop a fluency in our style and our strategy that reflects the particular interest in this particular negotiation. So it's not like we only do one type of negotiation. We could be negotiating, you know, a real estate purchase, which is typically kind of zero sum. We could also be negotiating with my counterparts in marketing to try to get them to do stuff I need them to do for this product launch, right? I could also be negotiating with my spouse, right, in terms of trying to get them to be able to be more responsive to the demands of work or the demands of household or the demands of our pets and animals, right? I can negotiate in all those different dimensions. But if I think of them as a fight, right, then I'm basically making this a much harder process. So what that means is that if we do embrace this perspective, then we're going to really need to be clear about what's a good deal in the particular situation we find ourselves in. And so you could sort of think about this as, well, how do I know what a good deal is? I mean, what's the parameter? What's the guardrails that help me figure that out? And while there are lots of ways to plan and prepare for a negotiation, there are really three parameters that are really sort of provide a structure around a negotiation. The first one is, what are my alternatives? What happens to me in the case of an impasse? And alternatives are really important. And this is actually a very popular area of research. And while there have been hundreds of studies that have looked at the impact of alternatives on negotiator performance, while there's lots of nuances with all those studies, the main effect is really clear. And that is those folks with the better alternatives walk away with more. And that's really interesting because if you think about it, alternatives are outside the negotiation. So if you and I are negotiating And maybe I'm negotiating with you for a new position in an organization. My alternative might be my current position. It has nothing to do with you, right? It's a completely different entity. Or, you know, so I find myself looking at my current position, or maybe I have an alternative offer. So I have two offers, right, to my current position. Those are all alternatives, right? But having good alternatives allows me to do better in the negotiation with you. And the reason is because your biggest source of power in a negotiation is your ability to walk away. Having good alternatives makes it easier to walk away. So the better my alternatives, in effect, the more on whatever dimension we're looking at of more, the more you have to pay me to stay engaged in this negotiation as opposed to going with one of my alternatives, right? So that's a really, you know, powerful effect. And we can show you study after study that demonstrates how the level of a person's alternatives dramatically affects the outcomes in their negotiation. However, there's a downside to this. And the downside is that most of us, when we think about alternatives, we look at them as sort of a standard, like a reference point. Here's my alternative. And we're negotiating over here, right? And I say to myself some variation of the following sentence. If I can just exceed that alternative, I'm doing well, right? Now, that creates a problem. And the problem it creates is what I've just done by that sort of mental gymnastics is I have anchored myself to my alternative. So my goal is to just get above it, right? To just beat it, right? Which means I'm being affected by that. And so what happens is people talk about alternatives. There's a lot of jargon in negotiation. They talk about it as a BATNA. You may have heard of the term BATNA, best alternative to a negotiated agreement. I intentionally never use that term. And the reason I don't use that term is because it makes it sound positive, like something we aspire to. It's my best alternative, right? What I want you to think about your alternative is that your alternative is a safety net. And so, you know, it's, think about this. This is my favorite analogy for alternatives. And that is, imagine yourself a trapeze artist and you are performing before a large audience. You've done a lot of practice. You work all, you know, most of your preparation is practicing your act. And so you begin the act and somewhere in the middle of the act, something happens and you end up in the safety net. Okay. This is not an acceptable performance. This is not what you are aspiring to, right? But if you are in the safety net, you are really glad it's there. And that's how I want you to think about your alternatives. It's not something that determines what a good deal is. It's what protects you from the fall. Now, again, your alternatives are outside the negotiation, but they have their impact in the negotiation, and they have that impact through your reservation price. Your reservation price is your bottom line. Your reservation price is your point of indifference between a yes and a no. So you and I are negotiating. My reservation price is the worst possible deal I can say yes to. Okay? And when I say you're indifferent between, there's your point of indifference, I'm really being very serious about that. What I mean is if you are at your reservation price, you should be okay, absolutely okay with pulling out a coin and flipping it. And if it lands heads, you walk away. And if it lands tails, you say yes. So that's how indifferent I want you to be. So your reservation price is clearly an important component in your negotiation preparation because it defines where the negotiation goes from one you could say yes to one you should say no to. And that's a really important reference point for you to have, because otherwise, sometimes people just get caught up in wanting to get to yes, right? And so they begin giving away more and more and more until the deal is now no longer good, but they are so committed to getting a yes, they don't feel they can walk away. And oftentimes, we are motivated, and this is what is, I think, really interesting. Most of us have this view that the only measure of success in a negotiation is, did I get a yes from my counterpart? And that's what I'm really working against, because my view is that, sort of tongue in cheek, but not really, if every one negotiation that you engage in ends in a yes, you're not asking for enough, right? And so this is one of the challenges that we face, is that people think, well, I need to get a yes. So that means I have to keep conceding until I can get the other side to say yes to me. And the answer is no. You should have a point, right? Where that line says, you know, above this or below this, depending if you're a buyer or a seller, I will not go, right? The deal doesn't make sense now, And if you don't know where that deal or that point is where the deal goes from, okay, being okay to not making sense anymore, then there's no way to really stop that, you know, stop that concessionary behavior on your part. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that because we are so motivated to get a yes, we do a lot of crazy things when we negotiate. And I think that for me, my favorite example, which many of us can relate to, is if you've ever, think about the first time, if you've purchased a home, think about the first time when you began contemplating the possibility of a home, right? You're buying your own home. And so you probably had a conversation with your banker, your parents, your spouse, your partner, and said, well, how much can we afford to pay, right? You need to have that kind of number in your head, like what can we afford in this house search? And you come up with a number, right? And let's say you're working with a real estate agent, and wisely, you do not share that number because your reservation price is arguably one of the most strategic pieces of information that you have in your negotiation. And so, but you say to your real estate agent, because obviously you need to give them some direction, you say, I'd like to look at houses in this range. And you give them a fairly broad range. And you begin to look. And you look. And you look some more. And it is an incredibly depressing process if you've been through it. It's like, I cannot believe that this is the kind of options I have given all this money that I'm contemplating spending. And so, you know, you find yourself kind of being really, really depressed, really sad. And your realtor sees your sadness and says to you, I'm sorry that we haven't found anything that brings joy, but there are, given what you've liked in some of these places, I think I have a few houses that you might really like, but they are beyond the range you gave me. Would you like to see them? Desperate, of course, you say yes. And as luck would have it, in that group, you find the house. Now, here's the problem. It doesn't matter how well you negotiate. You cannot get the seller to sell you that property for equal to or less than the most you can pay, the reservation price. So, you know, we can think about it and say, well, what should you do in this situation? Well, what should you do is very clear. You should walk away. Because your reservation price is that point of indifference. And if you can't do better than your reservation price, at least you can flip a coin. But if it's greater than your reservation price or less, depending on which way you're going, it's more extreme than your reservation price, then you should walk away. But what do we do? And what do we do is very different. We spend our time using that incredible amount of cognitive resources that we have to rationalize why the number we came up with before we fell into lust on this house, right, is wrong. And we have all sorts of excuses and ways to get around that number and, you know, justify paying a much higher price. Something perhaps as silly but commonplace as, well, we have children, but they're smart, so they're not going to really need a college fund. We can put that money into the house, right? You're going to start finding ways to justify a yes, even though when things were cool and calm and you were, quote, more rational, you were like, oh, no, this is the most we can pay. So that's the problem. Reservation prices are critical, but you've got to have the discipline to maintain your reservation price, right? It's not enough to just go in and get a reservation price. You need to actually be able to honor that reservation price. So
wow.
We've looked at two components so far. Your alternative, which is is what happens to you in the case of an impasse, and your reservation price, the worst possible deal that you could say yes to. If that's all you pay attention to, you will systematically underperform in your negotiations. And you will do so because of a very powerful psychological process. And that is that the expectations we have drive our behavior. So if I'm thinking so much about the worst possible deal, my safety net, then eventually that's where the deal is going to come out because that's where my focus is. And so in addition to a reservation price and an alternative, and by the way, those two things are really important because they basically save you from the downside, right? They keep a level where you mitigate the downside. But there's also the other problem. That's the upside, right? And the upside is what we need to pay attention to when we're negotiating because what happens is that if we have an aspiration, an optimistic assessment of what we could achieve in our negotiations, you see, expectations drive behaviors. So I need to be intentional about the expectations I have in this negotiation. And when I talk about an aspiration, I'm talking about an optimistic assessment. That is not some offer you throw out that you don't really have any commitment to. That is, you've done your homework, you've analyzed the situation, you've analyzed your strengths and weaknesses, you analyze your counterpart and their strengths and weaknesses, and you say, if things went really well for me, what could I hope to achieve? And that aspiration is important. And that aspiration is particularly important, setting an aspiration, because if you set an aspiration, on average, you will do better than if you didn't set an aspiration. Even though you may never reach that aspiration, setting that aspiration improves your average performance. And this turns out to be critically important, especially for women, because while there have been some systematic differences by gender, one of the most common is that women have lower expectations, systematically lower expectations about what they can achieve in a negotiation. So part of what my suggestion to my prescriptive advice to women who are negotiating is set an aspiration, then reconsider it, probably up at about 20% because your aspirations are probably too low.
That's an amazing advice. And actually, focusing on aspiration price has really helped me a lot recently, and I always keep it in mind now. And we've talked about how the good deal can be approached, and you talked about it a little bit, but can we just sum up what common mistakes lead people to settle for less advantageous deals? Right? We know what the good deal is, but we still go for less advantageous ones often.
Well, I think what happens is that people, this is part of what I said earlier, which is people think that the only way to be successful is to get a yes, right? To get an agreement. And if your counterpart is holding out, if your counterpart is being more aggressive, if your counterpart displays anger, regardless of whether they're angry or not, we oftentimes will start conceding. We, you know, basically say, no conflict, let's just get a deal, because that's what makes me successful is this deal. Having the agency to walk away, realizing that every negotiation, if you're in a negotiation, you have the opportunity to walk away. And the question is, do you know when it's appropriate to walk away, when you're better off walking away? And for the most part, I don't think that folks actually do go through this process I've just talked about, which is with alternatives and reservation price and aspiration. I think they kind of just go in and think about negotiations in some kind of improvisational theater. And they kind of go in and they don't plan and prepare, right? And they walk in and say, I can do this. I'll just, you know, basically do it by the seat of my pants and I'll be able to handle it because I'm smart. And what happens is they don't handle it well, but they never really know, right? One of the problems with negotiation is you never really know how well you do, right? Because you may think you did better or worse. That, you know, that's pretty common. I think I did pretty well there. I think I didn't do so well there. But a skilled counterpart can make you feel really good about your behavior in a negotiation, your outcomes in negotiation, when in fact you have done very poorly because, you know, because of the biases and the shortcuts that we all take as we try to discern how well we did in a negotiation, which is one of the reasons why I think it is critical for folks to actually get some systematic training in negotiation. Because, you know, a lot of what we do when we basically have courses in negotiation, when I have courses in negotiation, is I really focus on giving people insight into what could have been. They get, you know, you get your result from a negotiation in my class, but you also see lots of other people's results, some of which will be better than yours for the most part, and some of which will be worse. So what did those people who were better do differently than you did? And what did those people who were worse do differently than you did? So be able to begin to develop a framework for how to be more effective in your negotiations. So, you know, one of the things that becomes really important is to understand that we are very poor judges of how well we do in a negotiation. In fact, there's some interesting research that suggests that the correlation between how well we think we did, subjective assessment, and how well we actually did, objective assessment, is probably negative. That is, when we think we did really well, you probably didn't. When you think you did poorly, you might have. And especially, you know, for example, Juliana, you said I focus on my alternatives, right? Well, you're rarely going to achieve your alternatives. And so you may feel worse because you didn't achieve it. But on average, if you compare the Julianas who didn't set an aspiration with the Julianas who did set an aspiration, the latter, those who did set an aspiration, will probably do better than the former, those who didn't, right? But yeah, those who didn't set an aspiration will feel better about their negotiations. So this is the paradox, right?
That's my favorite insight from the whole course. Mm-hmm. And now whenever I end up negotiation not feeling very satisfied, I'm like, okay, I've done well. Probably I've done well.
It could be that you did well because you didn't plan and prepare. I mean, you think you did well, but of course, when you plan and prepare and you think you didn't do well, it's probably because you're comparing what could have been aspiration with what you did. Right.
That's incredibly insightful, Maggie. I want to switch and talk a bit about the choice to negotiate. In my understanding, it's about recognizing the moment to negotiate and overcoming our own hesitations. Because we often encounter moments in our daily life that present potential negotiation opportunities, but it's easy to try to avoid them due to fears of being seen in a negative light, especially, as you mentioned, for women. Maggie, could we talk how we can get better at spotting these opportunities and what strategies might help us to overcome this reluctance to negotiate?
So, you know, if you think about, you know, and I've actually looked at this both in research and then engaging with people to figure out what stops them from negotiating. And there are really two big sort of buckets of behavior. And the first bucket is, I didn't even consider it as a possibility. I mean, what do you mean? You can't negotiate here. And we have a, depending on the culture of home, our culture of origin, or our culture of country, depending on where we grew up and our growing up experiences, we may have very different views of what is and is not negotiable. And so one of the challenges that we face is, you couple that sort of cultural difference about, you know, with the notion that I'm uncomfortable with negotiation, right? I don't want to get in a fight. You put those two together, and what happens is people have what psychologists refer to as motivated misperception. I'm uncomfortable with negotiation, therefore I don't see situations as opportunities to negotiate. Rather, I just say to myself, it's very simple, easy to say, you can't negotiate here. Right? It's just not done. It's as if there's a book of rules someplace and on page 16 it says, you don't negotiate here, right? The price is fixed by economist colleagues. Basically, supply, demand, quantity, price, all fixed. It's just a function of the market, right? And my view is, you know what? I'm going to ask. And the main challenge that blocks people from asking is their own reticence. So one of the things that I do in my negotiation class when I have an in-person class, and actually when I have a virtual class, I have a slightly different version of this exercise. But I ask people to go out into the world and purchase a fixed price item or a fixed price service, right? And then to receive credit for the exercise, you must bring back proof and the item that you purchased it for less than the fixed price. If it's on sale, less than the sale price, less than anyone could get that thing for at the moment you did, you have to get less, right? And when I first basically described that assignment, especially with my MBAs at Stanford, they're like, you can't do that. I said, yes, I don't want you to go to used bookstores, estate sales, any place where you would normally think, oh, it's negotiable. No, I want you to go to fast food joints or grocery stores or department stores or, you know, talking to the airline representative who says you can't get a refund for that non-refundable ticket. I want you to talk to those people, right? And find a way to be effective in your negotiations and getting more of what you want, which is getting a better deal than they're being offered and that they would be offering to anybody. Now, when I make that assignment, students are not happy. They're like, you can't do this. It's not possible. And about 15% of my students think, oh yeah, I can accomplish this. And those 15% in the sort of normal MBA class are predominantly composed of my international students who realize that not everything is a fixed price, right? But even when it says it's a fixed price, it's not necessarily a fixed price, but you need to ask. And so when the assignment is due, it turns out that about 85% of folks have been successful in the assignment. And they're surprised. I couldn't believe, right? And they're surprised because it was actually pretty easy. This is a really easy assignment. But we have all this psychological resistance, right, to the notion of negotiating in situations where we might be embarrassed, right? And I say to them, look, if I go into Nordstrom's, right, a reasonably high-end department store, and I find something that's a little pricey that I want, and I try to negotiate, if they won't sell it to me for less, I could still buy it at the price they suggested. They're not going to put my picture up on the cash register and say, she cannot negotiate, she cannot buy anything here anymore because she tried to negotiate. Can you believe that? No, they're not going to do that. And so part of what happens is that if you attempt to ask, you will probably be pleasantly surprised how often people try to accommodate your request. Now, again, I will say to them very upfront, you will not get a yes on everything you ask for. You will not. But if you don't ask, you already know what the answer is. So all you can be is exactly where you are right now, or perhaps better off when you are surprised by how accommodating people might be to your request. And it turns out, of course, that that's exactly what they find in the exercise. And what I hope to convey to them is that the choice to negotiate is yours. And, you know, you can't rely on there to be a sign someplace saying, we negotiate prices, right? That's not going to happen because the seller has a self-interest to set the price and have you agree to that price. Interestingly, a more subtle motivation is they'd also like to sell their goods or services, right? So they need to have people who are willing to pay a price, maybe not that price, but a price. And is it better off for them if you offer, you could, you know, the traditional sort of Western or U.S. centric kind of perspective is, well, the price is fixed. So if I can't afford it or don't want to pay that much, then I just go away. Well, maybe offer the seller the opportunity. Maybe you would like me to buy it, but if I buy it for this price, would you be willing, you know, I'll be willing to buy it at this price if you're willing to sell it for that price. And again, it's all voluntary. I'm not holding a gun to anybody's head. I'm just saying, I don't want to pay that. Here's what I'm willing to pay. What do you think? Right. And so that's the big lesson I want people to take away with from that experience is that oftentimes this notion that people don't negotiate or I can't negotiate here is a self-inflicted, you know, sort of barrier, not about how it really exists. So that's number one. It's basically, we've got that. Then the second component, and Yana, you mentioned this, is that people, you know, sometimes are concerned about how they'll be perceived, right? And this often happens when you're negotiating for a potential, you know, relationship, right? So maybe I'm negotiating with an employer for a job, and I'm concerned because of the adversarial nature, this battle mentality that we have for negotiation, I'm concerned that if I actually negotiate, people will think ill of me. They will think I'm greedy or demanding or not nice. And, you know, it turns out that that's a big problem. And again, as you mentioned, especially for women, because there is a differential standard for what is acceptable behavior from a woman and what is acceptable behavior from a man. It turns out that the research is really clear here. Let's say that I'm negotiating a compensation package in my new position, and I'm a man. There's not a lot of backlash. I can do that with pretty much, you know, no long-term reputational hit. But if I'm a woman, I can use exactly the same words. I can have exactly the same levels of competency. Everything else can be the same, but I happen to be a woman rather than a man. Then it turns out that there's going to be a backlash against me, right? People are going to perceive me as greedy or demanding or not nice. My reputation will take a hit. So, you know, you could just simply say, well, that sucks. And I, you know, it doesn't matter to me. I'm going to go ahead and push and negotiate anyway. Or, as I'm suggesting, you can negotiate differently, because it turns out that women actually do better when they pair their ask, what they're asking for in the negotiation, with a communal concern for the other. What does that mean? The problem-solving perspective, right? I'm concerned about finding a solution that makes you, my counterpart, better off. That's a communal concern for the other. Women actually turn out to be much better negotiators when they're negotiating for others. And the reason for that is, You're not going to call me greedy or demanding or not nice when I'm negotiating for my team. You will likely call me greedy, demanding, and not nice when I negotiate for myself. So what happens is we see how well women can actually negotiate when we take off this social constraint, right? I don't have a reputational hit when I'm negotiating for others. And women outperform men in representational negotiation between 14 and 22%. So that's a big benefit. Women do worse on average than their male counterparts do when negotiating for self. So it kind of says to you, just realize that it's not that you're a bad negotiator. It's that you're basically facing a different set of challenges. And those challenges require a different response on your part. And this is one of the things that led me eventually to this notion of collaborative problem solving. It was first developed as a response to what I saw as the gender problem, right? And so, you know, because women are really good at solving problems. We've been solving problems for a long time. And we are also good at solving problems because we oftentimes have a limited amount of resources, right? So we've got to be more creative. And this is exactly what I talk about when I talk about collaborative problem solving. You've got to have a creative stance to figure out how can I do well and allow you to do well as well, right? Too many wells in that last sentence, but you get my point.
Well, thank you so much for touching down on this topic and like opening this important discussion about gender issues in negotiation. And you've mentioned like women setting lower expectations for themselves. You've mentioned like women being perceived as too pushy. And what are other challenges that women do face in negotiation scenarios?
Well, we used to, and this is not that long ago. It's probably in the 90s, right? We used to think that the big problem was that women didn't ask. Right. And we go back and that's even the title of a book that I think is really useful because it talks about the research that we had in gender. But Women Don't Ask: Negotiations in the Gender Divide by Sarah Lashevere and Linda. OK, I'll tell you in a minute anyway. And so what happened is that they did a series of studies and they found that women were simply resistant to asking. Because of this backlash that would occur, right? You get a hit reputation and, you know, you're basically, is like you say, well, I don't expect to get very much. And I get this terrible hit in my reputation is that I'm a greedy person. So it seems to me this is simply not something that would be viable, right? I don't want to do it. I don't want to put myself in that position. And so, you know, there was decades where we said, okay, the answer is women, get out there and negotiate. Go, right? You know, do it. It's your fault. It's kind of like blaming the victim, right? You know, you need to go out and negotiate. You need to behave differently, right? So subsequent research found that, in fact, our exhortations to women worked. They did go out and negotiate, right? They did step up to the plate. Unfortunately, what we found out was, there's still a difference. Women are still not basically on parity with males. And so it turns out that we did a study that was published in 21, where we basically got 2,500 pairs of negotiators. And 40% of these negotiators were males, male-male dyads, two-party negotiator, both males. We had 20% that were female-female. And then we had another 40%, which were one male, one female. And we looked at their performance in a stylized negotiation, right? So they all did the same negotiation. They were all in negotiation programs. So, and that becomes relevant in a few minutes. I'll tell you why. But what happened is that people negotiated, then we looked at the results and we tried to pick apart to try to discern which of the following two perspectives dominate. And the first perspective is that the reason women get less than men is because women don't ask for as much. That's the women don't ask strategy, right? They don't ask for as much. It's the tameness, right? You don't want conflict. You don't want the reputational hit. So you actually ask for less. Okay, that's one possibility. Because what we do know is men outperform women in negotiation. We just didn't know why. The second one is that men and women don't necessarily behave differently, but there's a different standard for women. And as a result, when women negotiate, the pressure and the pushback, the backlash, as it were, right, is what causes the disparity, right? Women ask for the same thing that men in equivalent positions do, but society is resistant. And so as a result, women get punished for asking that. You get a bad reputation or whatever, right? So we then analyzed the data, 2,500 dyads. And these dyads were composed of people, we already told you the gender distribution, but they were also C-suite folks. They were undergraduates. They were folks from various countries around the world. We did our best to be as general as we could with our sample. And we found something, there were a couple of things that were pretty interesting. Number one, we actually found no difference in the performance of males and the performance of females on average, okay? And the probably the reason for this and why it didn't necessarily fit with past research is not only that research was past and things have changed, but also because everyone who participated in this study was actually in a negotiation workshop. So it wasn't that they had the opportunity not to negotiate. So everybody had to negotiate, right? But the thing that we found when we analyzed the data was that there was clear evidence for the backlash account, not the tameness account. The tameness account, remember, would say, well, they don't ask for as much, and that's why they don't get as much. The backlash account says something happens in the negotiation and people get pushed back, right? They get told no. And that's where the research results led us to that second perspective. And what happened, what we saw was, think about alternatives, right? We've spoken about alternatives earlier today. And so what happened is you can sort of think about negotiators, and I have a good alternative or a poor alternative. Well, if I have a good alternative, I'm going to be asking for more because, you know, I have a great alternative. I can walk away. It's easier to do that. And so what happens is we find a situation where when men have good alternatives, they do really well. When men have poor alternatives, they do less well. On average, we found that when women do have good alternatives, they do well. And when they have poor alternatives, they do less well. But we also looked at the intersection. And what we found is that when women had good alternatives and they negotiated against someone, male or female, with poor alternatives, the woman did better. Pretty much a straightforward anchoring effect, right? But when men, and the men had that same pattern of results, but when the men negotiated with a strong alternative against a counterpart with a strong alternative, the protagonist that we're looking at here, this person, did better than the other person, right? When we looked at women who had a good alternative negotiating against a male or female who had a poor alternative, the woman did better. When we looked at, I know it may be confusing, right? When we looked at women who had a good alternative compared to negotiating with males or females who had good alternatives, the negotiation was 6 times more likely to end in impasse, which means this is the supporting the backlash. You're demanding a lot. You're demanding no more than the males in the equivalent situation would demand. But from a woman's perspective, our role in society is to make people feel good. And when I start demanding things from them because of my alternatives, I don't make you feel good. And therefore, there's a backlash potential. And so what we found was 6 times more likely the negotiation ended in impasse. And so performance for women was lower than performance for men because of that. And it's not like we don't know that. We know that happens, right? We may not know it empirically, but we also know that if we ask too much, we get slapped down sometimes.
That's incredibly helpful to know. And I would say that my life has been partially changed when I found out this all. And reflecting on your insights, Maggie, I'm reminded of times I hesitated to negotiate, worried about being seen as too pushy. Your research really hits home here. And it's not just a personal struggle. It's a widespread pattern many women encounter in the workplace. And thinking back to moments when I might have accepted things as they are, rather than standing up for myself.
But the point is, Jana, when you embrace that collaborative problem-solving perspective, right, what happens is people may come in and say, we're going to negotiate. My view is, I don't negotiate. I love this response. I was asked by, before I sort of retired, I was asked by the Women in Management organization at Stanford in the business school to give a talk. And so I usually once a year would give a talk on negotiation for people who couldn't get into my class or whatever. And so I said, well, okay, what would you, is there a particular topic you would like me to talk about? And they said, oh, yes, we want to talk about negotiating salary. Okay. So I have my PowerPoint because faculty can't speak without a PowerPoint, which belies what I'm doing right here. But so I had my PowerPoint, and the title of the talk was Negotiating Your Salary and Other Stupid Ideas. And they're like, they were like, but Professor Newman, you tell us we shouldn't negotiate our salary. I said, no, what you shouldn't be doing is negotiating your salary only, that is a single issue, because that's where you're going to get maximum backlash. So if you embrace this collaborative problem-solving perspective, number one, women have been solving problems forever, right? You know how to do this. So when people say to you, let's negotiate, they're already armoring up. They're getting ready for a fight. And my response, and you can imagine it's going to be, the standards that I experience are going to be a little tougher than most people, because I write books in negotiation, I teach negotiation, I do research in negotiation. So whenever I was in a situation with a team where I was the team leader, or I was working with one of my colleague faculty members, they were always like, you're negotiating with me. And they're like armoring up. And I'm like, no. I might negotiate with them out there. But you, let's problem solve. Because it's a relationship, right? Right. And so in doing so, right, I changed the conversation. I changed the tenor of the conversation. And so, how hard is it for someone to think of you as greedy or demanding or not nice when you're helping them solve their problems? And so part of what I just want to highlight is that while it is difficult to embrace this perspective and actually operationalize it in your negotiating life, it's really critical, because it helps you create an opportunity for getting so much more of what you're trying to achieve in the negotiation, because you're not fighting. I don't fight. I negotiate, but most people have this very limited definition of what negotiation is. And so it's just easier to say, oh, I don't negotiate, right? But I'm certainly willing to help. Let's kind of put our heads together and figure out a solution to the problem that we face. That's a different thing. That's problem solving.
So that wraps up the first half of our insightful dialogue with Maggie Neal. We've covered a lot, like how mixing economics and psychology can change the way we think about negotiations, and why working together is better than fighting, and what specific challenges women face in these situations. And for those who are eager to learn more, we are going to raffle the book signed by Maggie. So fill up the form that will be provided in the description to this episode, and leave your email for a chance to win this amazing book that literally changed our lives. And let's switch to the team dynamics.
Right. We want to dive into team dynamics, which is a huge part of your course, Maggie. And a critical area of interest that emerged here is, how do team dynamics influence negotiation process and outcomes as well? And does the team change the course of negotiation?
Yeah. So the answer is yes, it does. And it can change it for good or ill. So what we know is, in general, teams are more competitive and conflictual than our individuals. So when I get into a team and I'm doing a team-on-team kind of interaction, there's going to be more competition, right? Because there's an us and a them. So one of the challenges we face in negotiation, we're already kind of tending toward this mindset of zero-sumness, right? Well, putting two teams together dramatically increases the pressure to sort of see an us versus them fight. So our research in this area has suggested a couple of concerns and strategies. And the first concern is that teams can be really helpful if your team understands how to negotiate to create value. If your team understands value creation, then you benefit from having multiple heads, multiple people focusing on the same kind of challenge. So you can divide up the roles. You can be much more effective in understanding the information that's being transmitted across the table. It's not one mind doing it all. You've got maybe three or four or five minds working on the same problem, and you can set roles. You can be the primary spokesperson, right? And the other persons can be maintaining a record of the offers and counteroffers. One other person can be focusing on how does what we're hearing jive with what it is we expected to hear, right, from our planning and preparation. So there's all sorts of, you could even go, if you want to go more adversarial, the good cop, bad cop kind of thing, right? You could do all those kinds of things with teams. And so in general, if you have a well-educated team in negotiation, they can be really helpful when you face a solo negotiator, right? So you can really be much more effective. However, if you have a team that is not well educated in negotiation, and there are people who are just like, they're playing out their, you know, their sort of rather simple-minded views of negotiation, then a solo negotiator can dominate. They can do much better than you because they have much more of a framework of how to be effective negotiators. So one of the challenges is that you really need to think about how you prepare for a negotiation in a way that is quite different and that is more complex than how you have to prepare for a solo negotiation. So what that means is the main thing I have to do is I have to realize that I have lots of people on my team, and I have a natural tendency to think that because we're on the same team, everybody thinks alike. And so we're all aligned with our goals and strategies for this negotiation. But that's a false assumption. It's a dangerous assumption. It might be true, but it might not be true, right? And so the first negotiation, in effect, when I'm doing a team-on-team or a team-on-solo negotiating, is to say to my team, what are we trying to achieve? How can we get there? What's important to us? I need to coordinate the team on its goals and the strategies and the script that we're going to use when we negotiate. So part of what happens is my first negotiations with my team before I even begin to look across the table, right? And oftentimes people will forego that initial negotiation because they'll make the simplifying assumption that we're on the same team. So obviously we have the same interests. What that does then is it really causes the team to sort of be individual actors, right? Who are trying in their own ways, which may be very different, to get an outcome that's good for, quote, the team, which it's not really a team, right? It's just these individual actors saying, well, I think I'll be better off if I do X right now. And then another team member might be saying, oh my God, don't do X right now, right? This is the wrong, you're going to screw up our strategy. Well, that was your strategy, not their strategy, right? So the problem is that you need coordination. And most folks don't spend that time. Secondly, you need to consider that people are going to be more likely to be more aggressive, more competitive. So you've got to be real intentional about making sure that people realize the value creation component to the negotiation. And then third, you really need to sort of think carefully about how you will know what a good deal is in this context, right? So, you know, are you going to kind of overwhelm your counterpart, which means they may give away a lot to you, which you might think is good in the short term, but in long term, when they try to implement that deal, they may be impossible for them to implement it. So you really have to be kind of almost in the back of your mind, keeping in fact, how can we implement this deal? Because remember the negotiation, and whenever you do a negotiation, that's just the first part, right? You make a deal, and then now we have to implement the deal. And that implementation can be more or less problematic depending upon, I mean, you can be so assertive and demanding in the negotiation, they can agree to that because they feel like they have very little alternative in such a way that it makes it impossible for them to actually follow through, however good their intentions might be. So you need to be aware of what a good outcome is for all of you.
So thank you so much.
That's my main thing about that. Plus, when you have teams and stuff like that and multiple parties, you have the opportunity for coalition formation. It just becomes much more complex because, especially if you're planning and preparing, because you plan to prepare for yourself, your current team, and sort of get that straight. And then you've got to plan and prepare for your team across the table. And you have all different people who may have very different preferences. And that can be useful in a negotiation because you may be able to play one team member off against another across the table if they haven't done their homework and been coordinated.
Thank you so much. So, Maggie, the last question. You've mentioned that this is really an incredible opportunity for you to share the insights from your course with those people who have not yet taken it or have not yet read your book, which we strongly, strongly suggest to everyone. And in your book, which, by the way, everyone can win by participating in our raffle, you have this amazing framework for a successful negotiation, which consists of four steps: assess, prepare, ask, and package. And could you briefly walk us through this framework and how it can be applied?
So very briefly, because there's a lot of stuff underlying all this. Yeah,
there's a whole book on that.
Yes, the assess is, what is this an opportunity? This is sort of like the first component in the collaborative problem solving. Assess is it possible for me to negotiate here? Will I be able to achieve something here? So you're assessing basically the likelihood of success or the opportunity that negotiation presents itself. So that's the first one, assess. And then prepare. And one of the ways that I think is one of the things that I think is really critical and is an underserved or underutilized perspective in negotiation is preparation. And if you want to you want to know what mostly distinguishes successful negotiators from their less successful counterparts, it's the quality of their planning and preparation. And in fact, in the book, while there are 14 chapters, I have 2 chapters on preparation. So I really try to push Tom and I, my co-author and I, push the importance of preparation to help people be more effective in the negotiation. And especially the more uncomfortable you are with negotiation, the better it is to prepare because you have more control over the process then. And there we go through a whole lot of aspects of preparation. The basic one is alternative, reservation price, and aspiration, right? And then you can sort of keep adding layers of complexity on it. The ask is, once you've done all that, then make your ask and think about the collaborative problem-solving perspective. Basically, frame that proposal as a solution to a problem your counterpart has when you make the ask, right? Why are you asking for this? Well, here's how my resources, my knowledge, my skill, my ability can help you solve a problem of yours, right? So that's it. And then package. And this is a thing that becomes, when I was talking about the women in management, when I said, negotiating your salary and other stupid ideas, the reason is because they were thinking, let's just focus on salary. And I think it is a huge mistake to focus solely on a single issue, because a single issue, by definition, is a fight. There's no value creation there. It's either my gain is your loss is my gain. I mean, so it's just basically zero sum. Once we have multiple issues, as in a package, we take that package as a whole, then we have the opportunity to create value. We can craft a package that reflects the unique contributions that each of us bring to the table. If we have multiple issues, but we go at them one at a time, like a series of single issue negotiations, we're just creating opportunities for multiple different battles. So the notion is making trades. Our economist colleagues talk about this when they talk about gains through trade, right? Let me trade something I don't care as much about to get something I care more about, right? That's the kind of gains through trade. And what I want to do is find something that you care a lot about that's not that important to me, and something that I care a lot about that's not important that important to you, and make that trade, because then we both are better off. So the notion of assess, basically, is this an opportunity to negotiate? Plan, let me understand the whole process that's going on both in my interest and my counterpart. Ask, actually do the asking, basically make your proposal. And finally, when you make that proposal, package it. Use multiple issues. Don't get down to a single issue negotiation, because by definition, a single issue negotiation is a fight. There, that's as brief as I can be.
Again, that was a dive deep into the world of collaborative problem solving. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. Your mix of economics, psychology, gender aspect, team dynamics is just mind-opening. I'm sure our listeners are walking away with some game-changing insights.
And, absolutely, join Anna. The program and get the entire course.
We strongly, strongly recommend it to everyone listening to us. It's been an amazing program and absolutely fabulous course. And I know that Jana and myself, we use this course almost daily. And I feel we can say that our mindsets has been changed a lot by what we learned. And also your advice on being able to step away from negotiation, not only focusing on getting the deal, on saying yes, it's incredibly important. And thank you so much for giving us and our listeners some amazing insights to take away with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So to everyone out there listening, hope you find this is as cool and helpful as we did. Don't forget to check out Maggie's book, Getting More of What You Want. For more amazing insights, you can find the link right below this episode. And keep tuning into Mastery Talks for more conversations like this. We've got a lot more wisdom and stories coming your way.
And thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. This way you won't miss any new upcoming episodes. And follow the link to leave your email for a chance to win a signed copy of Getting More of What You Want by Professor Neil, which will change your life.